Okay. Well, it's not clear to me that you know, this is a choice that you make, or is this something that, you know, you're compelled to do, and whether or not you yourself see, you know, your students may see your. You seem to think that your students see you as a freak, but do you yourself?
I know it because they've said it to my face.
Really?
I have a very open relationship with my students. Okay. They can say anything to me. I promise I won't judge them. Okay, that's, we make that pact.
Okay.
And I've had them say to me, they said, the reason I don't want to go into academia largely is because I look at you and I look how you live, and I just know I don't want to live like that. You know, I mean, that's painful for me to hear because... You know,
and
like,
what do they see as wrong with what you're doing? I mean, you
no
do
family,
have
no children, no, basically here all the time, shoving dinner in my face and going back to work and just kind of scurrying around, doing a lot of different things and being frenetic and all the travel. You know, just it's exhausting. I mean, this job is really exhausting. It's self-inflicted exhaustion. It's within my volition to say no to things, you know, to not be involved in all these different projects, to not be like editing books and on all these committees, and you know, I'm on an NIH study section full time. I fly to Washington all the time. And, I mean, there's nothing preventing me from saying no. I don't have to have a lab of 35 people. I could have 10. It's within my volition to do that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just not within my nature to do it. That's the problem.
Okay.
You know, that's, I have a fundamental problem with the fact that if someone puts an opportunity down on the table, I really have a very hard time like passing on it. I see it as an opportunity, and I feel like I'm compelled to do it. So I really, like you said, I feel compelled. And sometimes after the fact, I'm like, what was I thinking? Oh my God, why have I done this to myself? You know, I haven't slept in weeks, and I really need a break. You know, and there's all these things on my calendar is packed for the next 2 years. My life is literally scheduled until 2005 spring. I can tell you what I'm doing every day. I mean, and so that's not fun, right? But at the same time, I feel like, if I can do it now, I should, you know, because there'll be a time when I can't, because
right.
I'm dead or something, you know what I mean, or exhausted, I don't know what. But if I can now, if there's any way I can figure out how to make it work now, I should just go for it. That's how I feel. And it's something is compelling me to do it. But I try and tell my students that you make those decisions yourself, you know, and you can have a really successful, fulfilling career with a smaller group and fewer distractions and a different approach and a family. And there's plenty of examples of that on this campus, just not really in the chemistry department.
Yeah.
But I think in MCB there are.
Yeah. Well, if you were to have children, how
would
your schedule change?
It would have changed completely. You know.
Yeah.
I would have had to have changed it.
Okay.
But so what we tried to do, my partner tried to get pregnant.
Okay.
So the reason I said a minute ago, I think I might be lucky, is for two reasons. One is that so my partner is female. Right? So
yeah.
I sort of have a wife, you know, the way that maybe some of my male colleagues have a wife. And so she'll put up with a lot more crap, you know, that I think a lot of male partners of female faculty might not put up with, unless they are also academics, and then they maybe understand better. But, so it's a horrible thing to say, but it's true. I mean, I think, you know, she gives me a lot more support than I think some of my straight female colleagues get from their husbands.
Right.
She maybe doesn't have as high expectations of me with respect to having more of a home life than the male, again, partners of my female colleagues. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's that. And also, that also relieves me from a lot of the social pressures. So I think my straight colleagues have, you know, they're supposed to be wives and mothers. You know, there's a lot of pressure from their families and from society, and people look at them, and I think they've grown up with that, you know. And I didn't, you know. For me, I was like, no one expects anything from me except to be a freak, you know, and that's, I can do that, you know. And so, you know, there really is no expectation of me. And my male colleagues don't really know what to expect from me. They don't really address me in necessarily the same way that they might address some of my straight colleagues, because they don't see me as sort of like a female somehow, you know what I mean? I'm some different thing. And also, I think I grew up, you know, when you grow up in our society, you know what I mean, if you're not straight, then you grow up with alienation. You know, you're sort of accustomed to feeling like you're the minority, the odd person out, sort of somehow alienated, not part of the thing. And you assimilate that, and you can deal with it. You know, so I have a lot of coping skills, you know, for dealing with being just kind of out there on the fringe alone, sort of separate somehow from not included in the majority. And I think a lot of my straight friends, when they go into academia, that's the first time they've really experienced what it feels like to be just like so kind of separated from the major group and so cut out from the center of the universe. And I mean, that's not a big deal for me. You know, I'm accustomed to that. So I think this has given me a little bit of, I don't know, maybe makes it easier for me because I had less to lose, you know, coming into academia than some of my straight friends who really felt like they lost, you know, they entered this world where they don't have a community and they don't have a support network and they miss that. But I don't really ever feel like I had that, you know.
Okay, well, you know, in terms of women scientists as role models, in fact, you're the standard, right? If you look at Barbara McClintock and Rosalind Franklin, they did not, with the exception that you actually have a long-term relationship, that they tended to be single.
Kind of loners.
Spent tremendous hours in the lab, chose not to have children. If you look at the current kind of science statistics on who the tenured female tenured professors are, they are white males with children, and the absolute minority is females of any color without children. But they're more representative than women
with children
of any color and are married. And so clearly, you know, I can't understand it. From that perspective, this isn't, this isn't an issue of being a freak. That this is the standard face of female mm-hmm. scientists. And you know, how much is this? How much is this just a function of the individual scientist as much as a construction of what science is,
my contemporaries, like all of my female colleagues, so there's only 5 women faculty in chemistry, but all of them have kids except me. They all have families. I'm the only one who doesn't. And in biology, at least the tenured, you know, the more senior faculty and most of the junior faculty also all have kids. So at least at Berkeley, it's very uncommon for a woman professor not to have a family. Actually, I can only think of one who doesn't, but she's young, you know, she's sort of an assistant professor. So I don't have a lot of familiarity with that sort of more classic kind of spinster or loner sort of female scientist. I never knew any.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I didn't know any female scientists when I was in college. And when I was a grad student, there were a few women in the faculty, but they all had kids. So I don't know, you know. But, you know, it's certainly easy to imagine how women would find the job so consuming. Or maybe they would feel like they were at such a disadvantage if they had children. Or maybe their spouses, if they had them, were so unsupportive of taking care of a family.
Right.
But I don't know, you know, maybe the women who are here now, sort of my generation, their husbands are more partaking in the child rearing, you know. I do know that a lot of my female colleagues, especially in biology, their spouses are also academics, you know. So they're a double academic couple, whereas my male colleagues here, like only one of them is actually married to another academic. All of them have wives some of them don't work, and they're just at home taking care of the family full time. And these are people my age. You know, a lot of them have wives that just quit working or work part-time. But my female colleagues who are married and have kids, their husbands, all of them are like professors, like here or something, you know. So I don't know, you know. I can definitely see how this job, it's a kind of job where there's like this many things to do and you could never do any more than like 10% of it. I mean, if you didn't sleep 1 minute ever and you worked every single minute of your life until you died, you'd still get like 10% or less of what you really needed to do accomplished. So given that reality, you have to figure out, you're going to have to draw a box, you know what I mean? And you're going to have to at some point just stop and say, okay, I'm going to do this much and then I'm going to stop and all these things are never going to get done. And you have to decide where you're going to draw the box. Are you going to draw it at a 60-hour work week or an 80-hour work week or a 100-hour work week, you know? And there's no box you can draw that's going to encompass everything you really need to do. It's just the nature of the job. It's too much shit to do. So we all draw the box in a different place. And, you know, I've drawn the box in a place where I can barely maintain my relationship and have a few days off to myself here and there and also have the time to feel like I give some mentorship to 20 students and 12 postdocs.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Yeah.
And if I had a family to fit in there, it would be a smaller box.
Yeah.
And, again, it wasn't really for lack of effort, you know. I mean, we did try for 2 years.
Yeah.
And when you're doing artificial insemination, it's very difficult because it's nothing. It's not like, oh, you just kind of, you know, randomly mess around for 2 years. I mean, every month you have to schedule things very carefully, and they spend a lot of money, and you have a lot of doctor's appointments. And again, every month, like month after month after month, this is really exhausting.
Right.
And after 2 years, we just couldn't do it anymore. It was too painful. It was too costly. And
yeah.
We just decided to call it quits for now.
Yeah.
But my partner's 40, and so, you know, she can't really wait forever. I think she's basically decided that's it. So if we're going to do it again, it's going to be me.
Okay, well, I wanted to ask, because you're in a unique situation. How did you choose who was going to conceive?
It was easy. Yeah, so she was older than I am, so she's kind of running out of time faster than I was. So she was 38 when or 37, actually, when we first started. And whereas I'm 4 years younger than she is, so there was that. Also, she had the biological urge to conceive.
Okay.
And there's no other way to put it other than, and I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. She was, you know, she just wanted to be pregnant in a way that you just couldn't explain, you know. And whereas I felt like, take it or leave it, you know, it's just like having, for me, I could have a hamburger or a pizza, you know, like I didn't really feel strongly. I thought it would be kind of interesting, but if it didn't happen, whatever, you know, I was perfectly happy to have her do it. And then when it didn't work for her, I sort of said, well, you know, why don't, maybe we should sort of switch uteruses, I'll give it a go. And she didn't want me to. She thought it would be too hard because she was so disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
She felt such a loss at not being able to conceive that she thought it would be really hard to have me hanging around pregnant, you know. Like, that would be really hard for her to witness.
Yeah.
Although I'm not really sure, actually. I think she would have been fine with it in the end. But now, you know, if I'm going to do it, I really better start thinking because I'm 36. And when you do artificial insemination, it's like that much harder than... It's hard enough to get pregnant when you're 40 the old-fashioned way, but it's really hard when you're doing it this way.
No, okay.
But, you know, I think at this point, it's very likely we'll just not have children. You know, we will just have more cats and maybe a dog, you know. But again, for me, I don't feel such a loss like she felt, because I have my grad students, you know. I mean, I have, and they certainly act childish enough at times, you know, so I feel like I'm fulfilled in that regard, you know.
Okay. Well, do you consider there's a life cycle to the life of a cycle to the life of a scientist, and then there are windows of opportunities when scientists can decide to have children? And, you know, it certainly is different for men and women, but when you're counseling your graduate students and they're presented with these issues, I mean, how do you advise them?
You know, I don't know. I've never had a student come to me and say, I'm trying to figure out when's the best time to get pregnant. That's never happened. I've had postdocs come to me and talk to me about that, and I've had postdocs get pregnant in my lab and have babies. Like Gia, my Uber lieutenant at LBL, she had a baby last December, and so did another postdoc just around the same time. And for them, actually, and I've had a lot of friends have babies when they're postdocs, and I think it kind of works pretty well, as long as you don't work for some asshole, you know? You work for someone who understands what it's like to have a baby and have a family and how that changes things. And, so I would say just watching my own friends have their kids as postdocs and watching Gia and Gusu do it, I think that's not a bad time if you can get pregnant. You know, you can't often snap your fingers when you're pregnant when you want to. I think, you know, I think it would be hard as an assistant professor. In chemistry, you know, most faculty start when they're a little bit younger than in biology because they haven't done this six-year postdoc thing and they finished their PhD in 4 or 5 years. So when I started my job at Berkeley, I was 29, and that was that's standard. Some even younger, 28, 27. And that's really nice because I was, in chemistry, they tend to rush you through everything is kind of accelerated and overblown, and we have big labs, we do things really quickly, and so we often tenure people in like 3 years in this department, you know. And in 3 years, either you're hot or you're not, and then it's just decision, that's it. You know. And so I was tenured, you know, I mean, I was tenured when I was 32.
Mm.
And so that would have been easy, you know, for me to start a family at the age of 32 if I were a straight person, you know, and be tenured. And so in chemistry, I think you can do it. Biology, you know, by the time they get tenured, often they're like 39 or 40. And then you're sort of pushing the envelope. And they really feel like pressure's on, you know, got to get kids now. Maybe they're 38, just about to reach that age, you know. But most of them are certainly over 35. And everyone teaches you that 35 is the point at which your fertility, like, plummets into the basement and you can just hear it crashing. So my friends in biology definitely feel a lot more pressure than in chemistry. Yeah. Chemistry, we're just a bunch of young, kind of, we're like little babies, you know, we get our jobs. And, but that's actually really good, I think.
Right. Okay. Well, you mentioned that one of your decisions, that you came to the Bay Area because of your sexual orientation, that you thought it might be a more tolerant mm-hmm. environment, but you kind of thrown out, well, you know, nothing is perfect. How
good memory.
Yeah. I want to talk about both homosexuality and science, but how has the Bay Area been?
It was a totally funky place. Okay.
Expectations.
Yeah, no, it's completely funky. You know, orders of magnitude better than Boston. You know, nothing. I really can't say anything negative about the Bay Area.
Okay.
Just relative to any other place, it's the best place I've ever lived. You know, in the sense, just basic life, people don't get in your face. You know, you can live like a human being here, which I appreciate. Like, we could buy a house.
Yeah.
And, you know, a real estate agent isn't like, you know, I mean, it's no big deal. You know, we could buy a car. And Cynthia comes to all faculty events with me. She's my official guest, you know, mm-hmm. like, so when I get invitations, it's Carolyn and Cynthia. Mm-hmm. She's always invited everywhere, and she knows the faculty. She's gone to faculty baby showers even without me, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I know that there are certainly faculties around the country that would not welcome her so openly as a spouse of a faculty member, you know. So not every member of the faculty here, I'm sure, feels comfortable with that idea, but it's such a big faculty that I don't even know all of them anyways, and there's enough of my most immediate colleagues, you know, treat her like any other spouse. So that has immeasurable value, you know what I mean, in that sense they treat me like a human being with respect. But, you know, when I came, the students here are not like people from the Bay Area. They're just people from all over the place that come here for grad school. Right, and a lot of them come from the Midwest. We have a lot of students from Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, really good flagship state schools, and these are kids who like the concept of big state schools and they want to come to the coast where it's warm, you know. And so the hardest thing is dealing with the young students who come here clueless and from very conservative backgrounds, a lot of them, who don't really understand the concept, and they, you know, have to deal with me in some way. You know, like, maybe they join my group, and then, you know, they're like, oh. Fortunately, students, and in fact, human beings, are such gossip hounds that I don't think there's any student that would join my group who hadn't heard through some gossip mill that their professor's like this big dyke, okay? So so that's kind of a filter, and I can't imagine a student ever joining my lab who couldn't handle it or for whom it was some issue that would interfere with our professional relationship. So I've never had to deal with a student in my own lab who was like, you know what I mean? That's never happened. I think the clue is out there. But there were students in other groups, you know, who I might have to interact with here and there. And, you know, sometimes I can tell they're very uncomfortable and they can't look at me in the elevator. I'm on the qualifying exam committee and they are weird, uncomfortable. I'm sure there are a lot of jokes, butts of jokes. I'm sure I'm the butt of many jokes and stuff of young 21-year-old males. You know what I mean? These are young men that come here, most of them, and so I have to, you know, I have to somehow exist among them and somehow command authority, you know, so that can be tricky. It was hard when I was a student here because there were, like, you know, 10 guys for every woman, and and for every, you know, 100 women, there was, like, one lesbian. So, I mean, it was just, like, I was it. And I got a lot of harassment from students, other students. Mm-hmm. Never from faculty, of course not. They were too cool for that. But, you know, just, and, you know, but I had my little, fortunately, I had a couple of gay friends, men, and we insulated ourselves with our little group. But I know that we, you know, I was afraid to go to the bathroom. Like, I was working on the 7th floor of this building, and there was no women's bathroom on that floor, so I'd either go up or down. And when I went down, I would just get, like, names, you know, these guys, there was this one hallway full of these guys, you know, and they would just, like, sling names at me, so I became afraid to go to the bathroom down there, and stuff like that, you know, which is totally, you know, I mean, this wasn't, like, the dark ages, this was, like, the late 80s, you would think, but,
Right.
But it was, this was a different culture even than now. I mean, you sort of have to put yourself back in that time. This was before Ellen and before Will and Grace, right? I mean, that stuff, you could never even thought of such TV shows back then. I mean, it was so taboo, you know? And,
right.
And this was, you know, Bush years. I mean, right after the Reagan years. And so that was the climate amongst students here. So it was hard, you know, to work amongst those students. Although I had a couple of incidents, you know, I had one particularly bad day where someone was calling me weird names, you know, and I let it get to me somehow, you know, and I went back up to my lab and I was like, damn, I was crying, I was really upset, I was like, fucking assholes, you know, and my boss came in, my graduate advisor, this, you know, group meeting at 10 p.m. guy, right, and he was a real tough guy, you know, and everything. He knew, he didn't care, because I worked hard for him, that's all he cared about, the guy was very practical. And he came in and he was like, what are you upset about? What, your reaction didn't work or something? I was like, no! These guys down there, you know, like, they're just calling me all these names. I'm afraid to go down there. And it's, like, so hostile. And how can I work when I was, like, I feel like I'm just in the combat zone or something. And he was like, what did they say to you? He was infuriated. He went down there and he kicked their ass. He went down there and he was like, you gotta learn how to treat people with respect. And where's this junior high school here? And you don't belong in a graduate program at a top institution. You don't know how to... I mean, I couldn't believe it because this was, to me, so out of character for this guy. He went down there and I was like, oh, my God, this guy just... And I was, like, so relieved, you know, that this boss, that this guy would go and do that for me. You know, he cared enough. Yeah. You know, so it wasn't all bad. But, yeah, it was tough then. And now I think it's better. Like, I have some, there's gay students around here, you know who they are. And actually, there's a few of them in my lab, and there's a few in other labs, too. There's a lot more women here now than there used to be. So our student body is, like, 35-40% women. My group has always been about 50-50. And so that changes the whole sort of climate when you just have some women around. That really helps a lot, kind of makes it a more professional, somehow sane environment. And like, men act differently when there's women around somehow, thankfully. Yeah. And so I think now you wouldn't hear that kind of stuff. Maybe the student sensibility, maybe the culture has changed a little bit, more tolerant. And they also know that if they said things, you know, if they treated a student like that and it got back to me, who's the professor here, I would come down on them like a ton of bricks. And I'd be like, your career is over today, and I will see to that. You know what I mean? Yeah. They know that. So Certainly out loud, you couldn't imagine hearing that kind of thing now.
Yeah.
So it's gratifying.
Right.
There's another a colleague of mine in the department who's gay, a young assistant professor, a guy. Yeah. And he says he came to Berkeley. He had an offer at Princeton, an offer at the Rockefeller. And he said he came to Berkeley because I was on the faculty here. Mm. And he knew that if I could get a fair shake here and be successful, so could he.
Yeah.
Okay. That was gratifying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think you're right in the you know, sensibilities, I'd like to think, have changed in that overt harassment is much more...
It's not PC.
Right, it's not PC,
yeah,
but
it happens.
The bigger problem is covert kind of discrimination, and how prevalent is that?
Well, since it's covert, I probably wouldn't know about
it,
yeah. By definition, but... I don't know, because, again, like, I can't do the control experiment, you know? I don't know what my life would be like here as a straight person.
Right.
I don't know how successful I would have been. Would I have been more successful? I mean, I think I've been pretty successful, you know? So I can't honestly say that I've been mistreated or somehow... I mean, I've had problems with certain faculty. Rarely. I tend to get along with most people here, and they get along with me, but I had, you know, one sort of bad encounter with a very senior person when I first got here, and it was very unpleasant to work with him in the same department, but then he left, thankfully, you know. So that problem kind of solved itself, or at least it became a long-distance problem, because he's still in the field, you know, and he was one of these people who didn't like having young people come up and sort of challenge him and so on, you know. And he felt very uncomfortable. Like, he was one of those guys who you could tell felt very uncomfortable around me. Like, couldn't look me in the eye. And especially when Cynthia was around, just, blah, you know, just couldn't even, blah, you know, thought it was disgusting and so on. But again, that, you know, I don't think it certainly hasn't undermined my career. I don't think you could really say that, you know.
Yeah, okay.
I think if I were a guy, it would be harder. I think it would be harder on my younger male colleague. Then
why is that?
Well, because it's a very macho culture, and it's, I think, easier to be a lesbian in a macho culture than a gay man. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Because if you're female, like I'm already female, I'm already kind of a freak and out there on the fringe, and so I'm also a lesbian, whatever, I'm already out there, you know. But this guy is expected to be one of the boys, and he's not, you know. And I think that will be ultimately harder for him, and I can kind of see it, you know. I think the students, again, you know, most of our students who do synthesis are these guys, you know, and they're kind of these tough guys, and I think it's going to be harder for them to work for someone like him than me, you know.
Does that mean that you have less credibility as a scientist than this other guy?
No, I think, we're sort of apples and oranges because we're in two different types of chemistry.
Okay. And
he's a synthetic chemist, which is the most macho of all forms of chemistry, and I'm a bioorganic chemist, which is a little softer, you know. And I have more women in my group. He has mostly men in his group, which reflects that type of chemistry and the demographics of it. No, I don't think I have less credibility. Actually,
okay.
I really don't.
And what about the level of professional societies?
Well, like the American Chemical Society?
Chemical Society. For instance, and this issue of covert, overt discrimination.
I don't know.
Harassment.
I mean, I'm a member of the ACS. I go to the ACS meetings, but there's like 100,000 members of the ACS. It's not like... I'm sure there are places, of course there are places, you know, in the country where they wouldn't even look at me, you know, even just because I'm female, forget anything else, you know. It's just that I don't hang out there, you know. I go to ACS meetings, I give my talk, and I leave, you know, and these are huge meetings that I don't really know anybody. And you know, I keep to myself, you know, I mean, maybe I'm not that involved in these things. I don't expose myself a lot to the potential for that. But, you know, I get invited, certainly, to be in a lot of committees, mostly because we need a woman, you know, to be in our committee. And despite my shortcomings, I guess, as a human being, as they might see it, but they still need a woman, and I'll be there, you know. I'm on the NI study section, and I mean, I'm on a lot of these things. So put it this way, if my being a lesbian excludes me from being invited to be on certain committees or participate in things, good, because I already have too much of that crap to do.
Okay.
And I really don't need any more, you know.
Yeah. Well, you'd mentioned yesterday that women have been persistently absent in the field of organic synthesis, but other fields of chemistry have been more appealing or have
more open
presence to women. And you know, some have made that argument with medical specialties as
like
well,
surgery versus pediatrics.
Yeah, and as cardiology became, you know, there was more women, that neurosurgery became more male dominated.
Cardiac has more women.
Well, cardiology is part of cardiac surgery, and you know that there was these shifts in the profession. What do you think accounts for why one particular field in chemistry would have a greater representation of women than other fields?
Well, you probably have to trace it back to the attitudes of the professors, mm-hmm. who were the sort of forefathers of the field, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And if early on in the development of a field you had a couple of influential academic types who were either women or very supportive of women, that would make a big difference. Because of the propagation effect, it's geometrical. You know, like in my career, I'll train hundreds of students and postdocs, and each one of them will train hundreds. And so the people who, you know, I will propagate exponentially with each generation of people that I've trained. And so if I've trained them in such a way that they have this intrinsic belief that women are competent scientists and can have leadership roles in science and can be superior graduate students and so on, that will make it that much more likely for them to have women in their own groups and train them with the same vision. And conversely, if I don't accept women into my group categorically, ever, and I send a message to my own students that women will never be as good chemists, that's why I don't take them, neither should you, and then that's going to propagate exponentially too. And that's what happened in organic synthesis. So there were a couple of very influential, you know, sort of founders of the field that had that mentality, and it wasn't hidden. They wore it like a badge. Two of them were on the faculty at Harvard when I was an undergraduate, and they refused categorically to take women into their group as students never had one and never would. And you knew that, so if you were a grad student and you went to Harvard, you knew that these were the two groups that wouldn't take women, so don't bother, and these were the two groups that would take women, and you'd have to go to them. And people accepted this. It wasn't like, they weren't like, oh my God, let's a lawsuit, let's hire a lawyer and sue these. I mean, it was none of that. It was like, okay, that's life, you know. Now it would be really hard to get away with that so publicly, but you know, back then it was just part of life and you just dealt with it. One of those guys won a Nobel Prize. You know, this is a very influential person. And then later, I think the last few years of his career before he retired, he had one woman grad student, finally, because what could it hurt him at that point? He already had the Nobel Prize, right? So it's that kind of mentality, and that combined with the amplification effect of the fact that this is a person who ran a group of 50 people at any given time and was churning out 5 PhDs a year over a 40-year career. And that's just, that is a lot of influence. And so a lot of his spawn then later started to adopt the same reputation as being not a friendly lab for women. You know, they had this attitude. And that takes a long time to heal that, because all these people basically have to die. That's how I see it.
Yeah,
and, you know, these are great people who've made, I mean, scientifically, they've made enormous contributions, and you have to respect their science, but at what cost?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it worth it? You know? Did that guy deserve a Nobel Prize? It's a loaded question, you know? Because, yeah, it's true, this person had a huge impact on the field in terms of the creativity, the chemical discoveries, you know, and certainly trained a lot of people who then went on to brilliant careers, and so they had a long-standing influence, and did maybe irreparable damage to the women who might have had aspirations to be an organic chemist. So what discoveries did we lose? Because those women will never realize their creativity and their potential as organic chemists. We'll never know.
No.
But the fact that that was rewarded with a Nobel Prize is kind of tells you where the priorities sit in the field. Mm. And that's, I think, you know, you have to look very carefully at those kind of stories. And so, okay, so now, those old days, now it's the new days. And so here I am privileged, because I have this lab where half my students and postdocs are female, which is rare in chemistry. You know, that's sort of a lopsided demographic. And so I have the opportunity now to propagate things, right, exponentially. And again, you know, hopefully a lot of these women will end up taking academic careers despite the freak influence that, you know. And it doesn't matter, because even if they don't, and only the men do, the men will have worked for a woman boss and will have worked alongside peers who are women who are equally competent, if not more so. And they, in ways that I'll never be able to quantify, that will have influenced their opinion of female scientists. So I think it's still, even if only my men ever became professors, which hopefully that won't be the case, it's still, I think, you know, something that will help. And, you know, not just me, there's other women too, of course, who have their careers now.
Yeah.
It'd be great to have more in organic synthesis, but again, the damage is significant.
Well, to talk about these numbers and representations, and, you know, I'm not as familiar with the chemistry departments as I am in, you know, molecular biology departments, cell biology, developmental biology departments, is that, yes, now we're seeing 50-50 graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
At the postdoc, it's maybe 60-40 women, 40% women. But when you look at the tenured full professor ranks, those numbers then get distilled down. So, you know, that would be one argument against this, you know, exponentially, you know, how can, and this has gone on for what? This is, you know,
but to be, to have the exponential effect, some you have to have faculty,
right?
You know what I mean?
Okay.
You can't even start the geometry until, you know what I mean?
Right. So how optimistic are you that these discrepancies will ultimately be overcome?
I don't know. I'm contributing to it, because if I'm a deterrent, you know, to women going from postdoc to academic, then so that basically goes, you know, that you're right, that's, you have to sort of divide the amplification effect by the anti-role model factor. I don't know. I mean, again, I only have my own experience to go on, and I'm just looking at my why. I've produced 15 PhDs, and you know, about half of them were women, and I'd say half of those women are planning to go into academic careers. Some of them are still postdocs right now, so they haven't yet made the real commitment. But the first one to finish her postdoc this year did take an academic job, so that's a good sign. My postdocs, most of them want academic positions. That's a good sign.
Well, how prevalent, you know, you keep coming back to this idea that you're somehow different.
No, I'm not. But
yeah, right. Okay, so your students have told you to your face. But how prevalent is a traditional role for women within the family structure among scientists, or women who want to pursue a professional career in science, that, you know, the traditional role of women has always been to be the caregiver and
maintain the home and so on.
Bear, obviously, but child rearer and caregiver, and take care of the home. And how have these, and all these advances that we've made, and you've certainly, you know, we have a lot of examples of dual careers. How prevalent is this traditional notion of women's roles within the kind of private sphere?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't travel in those circles.
No, okay.
You know, I mean, I hang out with a bunch of lesbians. Yeah, I really don't know what it's like for them. I can only tell you by inspection, you know,
right.
by looking at my students.
Exactly.
And most of them don't have kids yet, mm-hmm. so even they don't maybe really know what pressures will really fall upon them when they start a family. I'm sure most of them probably plan on having a family at some point, but haven't really thought out the logistics yet as grad students. When they become postdocs in someone else's lab, maybe they might start doing the math and say, oh my God, how can I do this, you know? But, you know, again, most of my postdocs, right now, they seem intent on an academic career, despite the fact that I think they also have ideas for having a family at some point. And either they haven't done the math, or it doesn't scare them, and I don't know which it is, you know?
I guess what the question is...
And again, I had two postdocs who had babies in my lab, mm-hmm. and I was really happy when they did. I was thrilled, but they were both pregnant and both going to have babies, because I thought that would be really great for my students to see that, you know what I mean? That, look, people are having babies, and you can have a life, you know, and take time off and come back and do what you need to do. And I had a baby shower for them. You know, I mean, I made a big deal out of it because I was like, great, okay, this is good. Because that provided them a different view of sort of a 30-something female than me, you know, because I couldn't provide that for them. You know,
and I guess what I'm trying to get at is how optimistic are you, how optimistic are you that we can, as a society and as both a larger society but also as a scientific community, move away from these notions of life choices have to be labeled either freakish or normal or abnormal, or that, you know, everybody, you know, that why would you just automatically assume that the choices you made are normal and mm-hmm. these students are not correct, that they're wrong to think that, you know, this is, you know, that you aren't just a role model.
Yeah, well, I think the important thing is that they have choices,
mm-hmm.
I guess. That's how I see it. They should know that this is a choice I make, and that on a dime, I could change my mind and make another choice, and that one of the great things about an academic job is that I have the flexibility to do that. And, you know, I haven't given them any evidence of that, but hopefully they would understand that it's true, you know. I think what's going to be important for a lot of these women is that they need to get more, there needs to be more participation from their partner. You know, they need to find a partner who understands that they have ambitions and that, you know, they might want a job that is going to take more of their time than June Cleaver, you know what I mean? And so they need to fill in those gaps. And, you know, and I think a lot of them actually are not deterred by the notion that it's a job that has hours that are sometimes extreme and that it comes in fits and spurs, and sometimes you have these moments where you have to work hard and that you might have to travel a lot and stuff. A lot of them, actually, I don't think that intimidates them. I just think they're going to have to find a spouse who can really rise up to it. You know, they need to have pretty high standards for their spouse, and hopefully they can find one like I did. I mean, you know, but it's not easy. I know there's a lot of pressure on these women from all different sides. I mean, they feel pressure from me. Carolyn expects me to be a professor, and she's going to be really disappointed if I don't. You know, I mean, they know, I don't say it, but I know they feel it. You know, and then their family, their spouse, I mean, I don't know how they deal with it. My life is easier. I came from an academic family. I had a lot of support for being a professor and working like a dog. We're supposed to do that. You know, my parents would never say to me, oh, you shouldn't be working so hard. You should slow down and have a family. They would never say that. You know, even if they wouldn't say it to my sister, and she's straight and has a husband and could have children any time now, but they would never tell her, like, oh, you're 38 already and you should really start a family. Are you kidding? She's married to her career, and that's laudable. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Right.
So, I never had these pressures. You know, I'm really lucky in this regard. And then I have a spouse who's female, who's basically a wife. I'm like one of the guys in my department. I have this wife at home who's cleaning my house, doing my laundry. I mean, you know. So how could I possibly understand what these women are going through? I mean, I have a very lucky situation. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, no, it's really hard. I don't know. You know, I wish... I mean, it would be really... I'd really like to get my students to talk to me about it more. Like, really, what do they think? But they're afraid to, because they're reticent, because they don't want me to think... I'm their boss. You know, they want me to think that they're not ambitious or something. I think they'd be afraid to say to me, like, I'm having serious doubts about whether I want to be a scientist or even have a career at all. I'm starting to think maybe I would like to just focus on a family. They would never say that to me because they would think I would judge them. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, would you say that to your graduate advisor?
Well, I wouldn't my have. Graduate advisor, no, but...
Yeah, because you're. What are they going to think of you, that you're not serious? And,
right.
And so I'm worried. My students probably would think that of me, that I wouldn't take them seriously. And so if that's really what they thought, they would never tell me that. So I don't think I would ever really get a candid...
Right.
It'd be hard to have an open discussion. And I've had the best luck with the ones that just graduated, so they're leaving, so they don't have to deal with me anymore. And I've had some that were right on the way out be very honest with me about things like that. Like, I had one who, she was so gifted, and from the very minute she joined my lab, I was like, this one is destined for greatness. You could see it. She was brilliant. And she's the one who developed the Staudinger ligation. She has a science paper in her second year of grad school. She was just absolutely brilliant. Everything she touched turned to gold. Brilliant writer from Bryn Mawr.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere around her third year of grad school, she started to pull away. Like, I was always like, oh, I want you to go give a talk at this conference. I want to send you to this meeting and introduce you to all these people. And I want to network you with all, I think you should meet all, you know, I was trying to, like, network her. And she could tell I was grooming her. And she didn't want to be groomed. And she started to pull back. She's like, well, I'm not sure I want to, you know. And finally I went to her. I said, what's up with you? You get this great result. You get all these papers, all this success. I want to groom you. I want to send you out to all these places and show you off. And you sound kind of like and then she said, you know, so the bottom line is I feel like you're sort of grooming me for some kind of high-powered academic job like yours, and I don't want to end up like you. And I was like, mm-hmm. No. Like, and that was why, because she said she wanted a family. She was engaged to one of the other students in my lab. They were planning to get married. And, you know, she just didn't want to... She wanted to raise a family. She didn't want to have to deal with the stress of be responsible for paying 30 salaries every month. And just, she didn't want the stress. She didn't want the time commitment. She wanted a 9-to-5 job, like in a biotech company, have a nice salary, go home, and have a family and stuff.
And do you have the same level of discussions with your male students?
Not really. Mm-hmm. Never seems to be an issue.
Okay.
Or they don't say it. Maybe they're embarrassed.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, none of them. Some of them have said things like, oh, I want to have a life. That's how they would phrase it to me. I don't want to go to academia. I'm going to go to industry because I want a life. But they would never say because of a family sort of thing. Just, I want a life.
Yeah.
Which might mean they want to go out drinking. I don't know what their life is. And also, they're very confident. The male students I have are very confident in their abilities. They never seem, or they don't express it if they're not. I've never had a man say to me, well, I don't think I could handle an academic job. I'm not smart enough. They would never say that to me. Whereas almost every woman has said that to me. Oh, are you kidding? I could never do what you do. I could never have a job like that. I'll never be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I can't believe, I'm like, what? Yeah. That's how, you know, they have a confidence crisis. What can you do?
Let me pop in a new tape.